The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Good morning. Thanks, Mike, for the introduction, and many thanks, of course, to everyone who's come out today. Thanks to Bill Edgar, John Eddy, and Mari Stout for the invitation and for facilitating my visit. I'm quite impressed with the Gospel and Culture Project and wish everyone success in its important work. Now, this is the moment in which the normally self-deprecating chapel speaker says something like, when John first invited me to speak, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to say. Unfortunately, anyone who knows me even a little bit, and especially family, friends, colleagues, students, anyone who was at last night's talk house, would see right through that one. Let's just say that discussions with my accountability partner would need to focus as much on James 3, 1 through 12 as on Matthew 5, 27 through 30. I've noticed, by the way, that this session has been given a title, Justice in the Environment. Fitting, of course, but perhaps ever so slightly ambitious for the time allotted. Maybe brief and quite possibly unsatisfying theological reflections on environmental justice will do. I'll let you be the judge. Though I never attended Westminster, yet this feels like a homecoming to me. Yesterday, I went out to lunch with Westminster's own Doug Green. Had a terrific time, but had to enjoy a cheesesteak. And the shirt I wore yesterday bears the mark of the cheesesteak. There is but none other than the middle of the shirt grease stain that I must now take home and use to admit to my wife that I enjoyed one of those while I was here. In 2006, my family and I moved to the Chicago area, leaving behind friends, family, and the church we had attended for 7 years, Christ the King in Conshohocken. During that time, we had the privilege of friendship with many Westminster students and alums. I actually have one of them to thank for encouraging what became my current book project. One Sunday afternoon, my wife and I joined Adam and Liz Bryce, Adam is the pastor at Christ the King, at the house of then Westminster student Josh Haney and his wife Melissa. Josh, Adam, and I were talking about climate change when Josh said, "Noah, you've convinced me. I think I understand this. What you need to do is write a book." While flattered, I explained to Josh that there were a number of good books available already, and that the one I'd like to see added would not be one authored by a social or natural scientist faced with the choice of either shortchanging the theological or biblical studies or presenting an overreaching case on the same. And it wouldn't be one authored by a theologian faced with the same choice on the natural and social sciences. So I told him I'd need a formal training in a second discipline. And he said instead I would need a co-author. The seed planted on that occasion has issued in a book project co-edited with Dan Block, which I think will do justice to the natural and social scientific interpretations, as well as to the biblical theological task. Some of the world's preeminent scientists will contribute chapters on cities and the environment, biodiversity, water, and climate change, while Dan Block, Danny Carroll, David Gushy, Doug Moo, David Toshio Tsumura, Chris Wright and Westminster's own, again, Doug Green, will take up the theological tasks. But I'm not only in debt to Westminster for Josh's encouragement. During our years here, I paid a number of visits to the seminary, and in 2002 attended the Contemporary Issues Conference titled The Earth is the Lord's. That conference has been formative in several ways. It spurred me on to continue getting my bearings concerning the biblical mandate of creation care. And not only the plenary talks by outside speakers, but those by Stafford Carson, Mike Kelly, and Doug Green made the most excellent contributions of all. Doug's daily meditations on Scripture were worth the cost of attending the conference, and from the moment I heard them, I hoped that someday they would appear in print and preferably as part of one of my book projects, and now they will. Finally, one result of the conference was that it demonstrated to me the apologetic advantages of creation care. On the last day of the conference, one of the plenary speakers, Cal DeWitt, invited me to that summer's upcoming Oxford Forum on Climate Change to present research conducted by University of Delaware's Center for Energy and Environmental Policy, where I studied and worked at the time. I was honored to be invited, but such an arrangement required the approval of our center's director, whose hostility toward the Christian faith was well known to me. My request to our director was for him a descent into cognitive dissonance. Upon hearing of an invitation to present our research at a Christian conference on climate change, he was incredulous, but resolved that tension by saying that if it were a Christian conference, then no one of consequence in the scientific, political, or economic community would be there. After all, Christians don't care about climate change. After I told him that Sir John Houghton would be there, he was doubly incredulous. The Sir John Houghton, the foremost atmospheric physicist in the world, the former chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Working Group 1, professor emeritus of atmospheric physics at Oxford. While my former director did not permit our research to be presented at Oxford, I believe that his hard heart had not for a long time been challenged as it was by the fact that the Sir John Houghton was a Christian who cared about the environment. Sir John's vocational commitments to intellectual rigor, coupled with his biblical commitment to creation care, was the seed now planted and watered. We shall see if God makes it grow. But it is important that we understand that Jesus' perfect obedience and his shed blood covered the iniquity of believers' creation neglect. Sadly, they do not cover the iniquity of unbelief by those for whom our own creation neglect is a stumbling block. Last night's talk house provided an excellent forum within which to have important discussions about these things and to weave together specific concerns for climate, environmental justice, and the church's task. Today we will broaden the discussion in two ways. We have obviously more people here, and that's very nice, but we will also be concerned with a Christian perspective on environmental justice writ large. First, let me speak briefly about how I came to this concern. From 1999 to 2001, I worked in support of community development organizations in Wilmington, Delaware, while pursuing a master's degree in urban affairs and public policy. It quickly became apparent that one could hardly do community development in that context without some knowledge of environmental history, environmental politics, environmental policy. 31% of Wilmington's unused and underutilized tax parcels are brownfields. That is, they're contaminated sites. Typical contaminants there include lead, arsenic, and PCBs, among others. In Wilmington, brownfields are usually abandoned industrial sites, but they also include sites of illegal and legal waste disposal as well. The vast majority of those are in marginalized communities of high minority population and or low income. Many census tracts with brownfield sites have cancer rates almost four times the national average. We're talking about cancer mortality rates that stretch well into the 600 person per 100,000 levels. You see, it's hard to keep a job when you're sick or dying. It's hard to stay in school when you're sick. It's hard to build affordable housing when expensive site remediation must be paid for before the foundation can be laid. And to the extent that community development has anything to do with employment, education, or housing, it was debilitated by Wilmington's urban landscape. The very possibilities for advancing well-being were constrained by the inequitable distribution of environmental risk according to race, ethnicity, class, and gender. This inequitable distribution of environmental risk in Wilmington, as in so many other cities of the global north, is a legacy of industrialism as well as a legacy of shifting to deindustrialized local economies. Now, environmental justice has historically been concerned with remediating this inequitable distribution of environmental risk. But it is certainly broader than that, including concern for the production, distribution, and consumption of environmental goods, green space, for example, and risks, it is no longer preoccupied only with the distribution of ills. But environmental justice is still about the ways in which we systematically produce risk and distribute the same according to race, ethnicity, gender, geography, and the ability to pay. Globally, the most vulnerable absorb the greatest environmental risks. And those risks usually arise from processes from which those populations, those vulnerable and marginalized populations, do not benefit. In the urban environment, the record is mixed in answer to questions of chronology. Are toxic wastes, for example, disposed in neighborhoods with high minority populations? Or do vulnerable populations of little means move into affordable neighborhoods which have lower rents because of toxic waste? Sometimes the answer to the latter question is yes. Even then, I think, we are forced to ask about patterns of production, distribution, and consumption that compel people to locate themselves in toxic environments. But as if haphazard disposal isn't bad enough, the records show that toxic waste and other hazards are often purposefully located in or near vulnerable communities. The sad fact of the matter is that economically efficient waste disposal opportunities are often found in communities too marginal to have a voice in the process. What's more, such opportunities are not so much found as sought. This much is incontrovertible. And environmental justice is not only a matter of toxic waste disposal. The landscapes that are sources for our oil, such as the Niger Delta, sources for our coal, such as Appalachia, are destroyed at great cost to human life and livelihood. When we consider our actions, we must analyze them from well to wheel, or from mine to smokestack and beyond. When I flip the switch in my office at Wheaton College, in the western suburbs of Chicago, 25 miles from the Loop, I draw power from coal-fired plants in poor minority neighborhoods in Chicago, which use coal from sick, marginalized, and vulnerable communities in West Virginia. In so doing, I contribute to asthma among children in those urban neighborhoods while contributing to unhealthy landscapes in the Southeast. And while environmental justice has conventionally been concerned with local conditions, our accidental, incidental, and now purposed intervention into global ecological systems and processes, such as the atmosphere and climate, now give it a self-evidently global dimension. The evidence is clear that human industrial activity is contributing to changes in the atmosphere and to our capacity to sequester greenhouse gases, which trap more energy in the lower atmosphere, changing the climate, making some places wetter, some places drier, some places warmer, and some places cooler. While the impacts are ubiquitous, they are not and will not be evenly distributed. They are projected to take their toll on the most marginal, those with the least capacity to adapt, and those who have contributed least to the problem itself. We in the United States emit approximately 28 tons of carbon dioxide and equivalent greenhouse gases per capita per year. A globally equitable and sustainable level, that is, the level of emissions that could be recycled by the Earth's carbon cycle. Every year, if everybody emitted the same amount, would be 3.3 tons. We emit approximately 28 tons. Now, that's not of carbon. You'll see a lot of different numbers. The way to understand this is that carbon and carbon dioxide don't come out in the same numbers. So there's a multiplier to get from carbon to carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide and equivalent gases is a little bit higher than just the carbon dioxide number, which is approximately 21. Still much higher than 3.3. And the U.S. pulls out of the Kyoto Protocol, claiming that Brazil, India, China, which are growing very quickly in their emissions, ought to have targets in the first budget period from 2008 to 2012. They don't have targets, and they should. Everybody expects them to have targets in the future under the Kyoto Protocol or another negotiation. China and India and Brazil emit fewer than 3 tons per capita per year of carbon dioxide and other and equivalent greenhouse gases. Though they're growing and though they have large populations, 8 Indian people to emit what I do in a year. More than 8. And unabated, global warming will destroy the lives and livelihoods of millions. Mostly of those people who've contributed little to the problem. I'm confident it won't destroy my life. I'm confident I can sit in my office in Wheaton, flip the switch and not get asthma. Somebody else gets asthma when I flip the switch. I'm confident I can drive to Wheaton and to Chicago, and I won't be subject to problems with sea level rise or extreme weather, because even when it gets hot and humid in Chicago, I'll just turn on the air conditioning. And we choose what problems we will abate. To a great extent, some of our interventions in nature are accidental to our system. They're when things go awry. Some are incidental. They happen all the time in the normal processes, but they aren't intended. Some are purposed, and we now manage air pollution. We now manage the atmosphere. We decide what are appropriate concentrations of greenhouse gases. We have annual meetings, more than one, most famous being the Conference of the Parties, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, where we get together and decide what's just the right amount of global warming. And I'm not suggesting we have much choice but to do that. But the way in which we do it ought to be a way in which we consider justice, what it means to do the righteous thing. These things are not technical problems. They're political, ethical, and economic problems. They're problems considering our values. A few years ago, the World Bank considered sponsoring an air pollution abatement program in Jakarta, Indonesia. And they thought, well, what are the costs and benefits of air pollution? How do we measure these things? Well, they're the costs and benefits normally attendant to either being at work or not being at work. Being at work because you're healthy and alive, or not at work because you're sick or dead. And so they thought, what does it cost when somebody in Jakarta misses work? Well, it's a day's wages. It's that much of their salary, prorated. What does it cost when they die? Well, you know, then they're not making money, they're not being productive, and you have to train somebody else to do the job. What'd they decide? Oh, it'd be more efficient to do that project in London or New York, where people make a lot of money, where it's worth it to do the project, where people are worth more. Because in Jakarta, it's just another dead Indonesian. We decide what we'll abate. If justice is the elimination of those margins, what should we do? If justice is that people pay the penalty for their own actions, which thankfully we did not have to do in one sense because we are in Christ, that we do not escape the ill consequences of our own actions, then what should we do? While there are many acceptable policy interventions, which I won't go into here because we could talk for months about acceptable policy interventions, I wonder how should the church be inclined to think and act about environmental injustice? Another topic we could speak for months about, but we don't have that long. The temptation exists simply to succeed, to accomplish, to achieve. It's the temptation that Uzzah faced in 2 Samuel 6 and 1 Chronicles 13. I know you all know the passage. David is transporting the ark back to Jerusalem. and they put it on an ox cart for transport, not the way you're supposed to transport the ark, of course, but God in his mercy did not strike them all dead on the spot. At one point, one of the oxen stumbles, and Uzzah reaches out to steady the ark. He touches it, and God strikes him dead. See, Uzzah was just trying to keep bad stuff from happening, right? He was just trying to do a good thing. He was just trying to keep the ark from hitting the ground. So he reached out, and he disobeyed, and he touched the ark. It wasn't Uzzah's job to keep the ark from hitting the ground. It was Uzzah's job not to touch it. And I would suggest we're all like Uzzah. This is our great temptation. I mean, Peter evidenced this, not just in his denials of Christ, but when he, in Antioch, would not eat with the Gentile believers when the Jews came to Antioch, because stuff would get real bad if he did that. So he took the matters into his own hands and touched the ark. And I think that we handle environmental justice issues and others this way. In 2006, 25 conservative, and the scare or air quotes are on purpose there, evangelicals wrote a letter to the National Association of Evangelicals demanding the firing of the Vice President for Governmental Affairs, Rich Cizik. Why? Because he had been activist personally, not professionally, but personally, activist about climate change. He should be fired, they said, because it was disingenuous. Oh, I'm sorry, he should be fired instead. There are three other D's. He should be fired because, in the first place, climate change is divisive. Climate change concern is divisive. He should be fired because it's deceitful. When he's concerned about climate change, it makes it look like everybody's concerned about climate change in the whole evangelical world, and we're not. So it's deceitful. And he should be fired because it distracts from the only three important moral issues of our day, which were, according to them, homosexuality, abortion, and sex education. Now, the third point is debatable. If you're going to say important moral issues, you have to draw the line somewhere. And I would have the argument with those 25 that there are more than three, and those aren't the only three, even if you had to pick. The other two points are disingenuous. It takes at least two positions to be divisive. Concern for climate change can't be any more divisive than not concern for climate change. It takes at least two to tango. And the second point is also disingenuous. Nobody wrote the letter before he became activist on climate change saying he should be fired because some people, like Noah Tolley, are concerned about climate change. And Rich Cizik makes it appear as if nobody is. And that's deceitful. But we're willing to do whatever it takes to achieve our ends. We're willing to reach out and touch the ark. We're willing to compromise the truth, to disobey, if it means success, if it means accomplishment. It's what Jacques Ellul would call the morality of the fact. Whatever succeeds is right. And in doing that, we lose the gospel. We do it on both sides of every issue, so don't get me wrong. This is our zeitgeist. This is the time in which we live. We do this thing according, no matter the context, no matter our position, no matter the issue. If I tomorrow were to wake up and convince everybody that they needed to act on this but soon by lying about it, and I could convince more people to act but soon by lying, I would undermine my witness to the gospel entirely. I would say, no, I will fix this thing. I will do it right. And there is nothing more important than this out there. Not the gospel, not obedience, not the kingdom of God. If I can overstate my case, just maybe some of you will believe it and do something about it. You see, our inclination is to touch the ark. And in order to recover our witness to the gospel, no matter the issue, no matter our differences, no matter the context, we must be willing to fail. We must speak and act with sincerity, clarity, and charity. We must prioritize desacralization of those things that will draw our attention away from the gospel. and reconciliation in order to show that our success is subordinate to the good news. Now, I've gone on long enough, and it's very nearly the time to end chapel. I'll leave you to title the talk according to your relative satisfaction. But before I do, I'll briefly recount a story. A number of years ago, I was in Costa Rica, and I was with a guide that I had known for some time and whose abilities in the natural environment there amazed me constantly. He'd saved me and others from certain death a number of times. And we were leading a trip with students at the University of Delaware. I was with him at the mouth of a river where the river comes out of the forest and meets the Pacific Ocean. And at certain times, the river's mouth is filled both with crocodiles and with bull sharks. It's not a place you enter into, and I lost my watch in there. I did not reach down into the water for it, or I might not be with you here today. But I dare, knowing no students were around and seeing a crocodile near the river, looked at me and said, "Come along." And he starts walking toward the crocodile. And I thought, okay, I'll walk behind him toward the crocodile, and a good ways behind. It's like the old story that if you're the prey, you don't have to be faster than the predator. You just have to be faster than the slowest person in the group or the slowest animal in the group. And I would walk behind Idare toward the crocodile. And we got very close to it, and I think very nearly within striking range, and the animal rolled over and swam away. Very powerfully rolled over and swam away. Now, I sometimes feel when I give a talk like this that people feel as if I'm asking them to walk with me toward the crocodile. I feel like people think I'm asking them to join me, and especially Christians, in approaching and getting too close to another reptile, and we all know how that story turns out. But instead of asking you to walk toward the crocodile, I'm asking you, as Doug said in 2002, to walk toward the gardener, to walk toward the lamb. To walk toward the lion. The lion who, if I'm going to appreciate my Wheaton legacy of caring for C.S. Lewis so well, the lion who is not safe, but he is good. So I'm asking you to join me in that. Thank you very much.